afternoon. It's Saturday, January 11th in the year 2003. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, and I'm your host today, Harley Schlanger, and our guest is a very special guest speaking to us from Paris, France. It will be Jacques Cheminade. Jacques is the president of Solidarity and Progress, which is the French organization associated with the LaRouche movement. Jacques has been a candidate for president of France in 1995 and then again in 2002. And what we will do in just a moment is we will begin an interview, but I want to give you the numbers and the email so you can get on quickly with your questions. Just before we begin, you can email questions to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. Now, oftentimes we begin with a bit of an update, but Jacques, I think you can provide that for us. You just came back from a very important trip to the Middle East where you were a guest at the Zayed Center for Coordination and Follow-Up in Abu Dhabi and then in Qatar. Why don't you give us a little picture of what you said there and what the response was?
Hi, Ali. Glad to be with you. Glad to be with the American audience.
That's great to have you.
Well, it was a very interesting trip. First, I was invited by the Zayed Center in Abu Dhabi, and then also officially by the International Center for Strategic Analysis in Doha, which is the capital of Qatar. There are small countries. In Abu Dhabi, you have in the Emirates, of which Abu Dhabi is the capital, there are more or less 3.5 million people and 600,000 more or less in Qatar. But they are extremely wealthy because of the oil drilling, and also they play a key role in the Middle East as centers of a sort of energy lung in the Middle East. And there are a lot of people who are extremely worried by the present situation. They generally don't like Saddam Hussein, but they understand now that the issue of the war has little to do with Saddam Hussein in himself, and that it would create destabilization and chaos into the entire region, and therefore they don't want it to happen. But they were, until now, a bit pessimistic on the issue. They see the American troops deployed, they see the Bush trip to Africa canceled in January, they see these 100,000 American soldiers coming, there are soldiers, American soldiers in Qatar and in the Emirates, and they don't know how to stop that, and they see that by themselves, from the standpoint of the Middle East in itself, it's impossible to stop.
Now, Jacques, Qatar, I think, is now the headquarters, isn't it, of the American forces in the Middle East?
Yes, and there was more opposition to it in Qatar than in Abu Dhabi in a certain way, because people are so worried of what they are doing, they see that as something happening and unfolding that they can't stop. So when they see people from the West, as we are from the LaRouche movement, they are extremely impressed, because they see that the West, United States, and Europe is not a one, that there is a fight going on, and that because of this fight, because of this combination of forces, and that's what I told them, war is far from being unavoidable, and we are in a situation where we can win for the cause of peace. But the thing they have to understand is that the real war is over economic strategy. Peace among nations and people, this is what I told them, demands a community of purpose based on mutual economic development. And this demands, in turn, to bankrupt the present financial and monetary system and to construct a better system, to go towards a better system defined by the new Bretton Woods and the Eurasian land bridge.
Now, Jacques, I saw on the Zayed Center website, they have a very nice picture of you. They identify you as a famous French intellectual.
And that was funny.
Yes, in the article, in your speech, you made the connection between a dialogue among civilizations and religions and also economic policy. Now, can you tell our listeners, how do you make that connection, and did they understand what you were saying?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There is a very interesting point to be raised before, is that in the English-speaking press from there, the newspapers are called Gulf Times or Gulf News and the Peninsula, the name of LaRouche was not mentioned, while in the Arabic coverage, the name was mentioned profusely. So it's very interesting to see that the pressures from the United States, the American embassy, create a situation where in English you can't speak about Lynn, but in Arabic you can. And what people told me at the end of the conference, in particular an Algerian that I had met when I had deployed to Algiers 12 years ago against the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, he told me, look, why are you sticking to France? There are many other countries where you are expected. You should know that LaRouche and you are the talk of the town in the Muslim world. So we are very respected because we say the truth. We don't
There's no question then that they knew exactly who you are, that you work with Lyndon LaRouche, and in fact, Lyndon LaRouche himself was there not that long ago.
In Abu Dhabi.
Yes.
In Qatar, it's a bit different. It was, for them, our presence there was an eye-opener. In Abu Dhabi, there were about 30 persons in the room and a very long question and answers period. People were diplomats, journalists, and experts from the center. In Qatar, there were 90 persons, which was a highly unusual audience, made of diplomats, deans of universities, strategists, friends of the emir, and even one or two dissenters. So even the French ambassador had to attend the presentation. And before that, we were invited at the house of a prominent businessman there, where I was a guest of honor with the ambassadors of France and Lebanon in second position. So it was, in that sense, quite impressive from their side. What they consider extremely important is to understand what LaRouche is doing with American presidential institutions, and an explanation of what are these institutions, these professionals, and also people in the army from the anti-utopian American tradition, people, flag officers of the ground army in particular in the United States, and retired officers, that these people exist, that they are a group. This is very, very interesting for them. They don't really know that, and they don't really locate from where the basis of what we are doing in the United States come from. When they see explanations on the youth, both on the youth movement and this action within the institutions of presidency, the connection of the two, and the super TVA program, the infrastructure program in the United States, combined with the Eurasian land bridge and an infrastructure program for the Mideast, they say, there we have something that is a policy of war avoidance. It's a policy of war avoidance, was the title of my speech, war avoidance through sovereign states' mutual development.
And I assume, Jacques, that some of them, given that you said that they are quite pessimistic and they had expected that war would already have broken out, they're probably quite interested in knowing how come war has not started yet.
Yes, well, it's very interesting to explain to them war has not started yet because of this combination of forces with LaRouche in the United States, with the youth movement and the institutions of the presidency, what Schröder did in Germany, what Chirac did in France, also the Russians, also the heads of Arab states, and that combination of forces has created a situation where the war has been stalled. Then what comes extremely interesting is when you tell them, look, if we want to win, if we want to have a yes to peace, it should not be a no to war, it should be a yes to peace, then we need to have a pro-development policy, an infrastructure development policy, and for that, we need to really create a new world economic order, more just economic order, based on the bankruptcy of the IMF system, that we should put the IMF system into bankruptcy, and create a new long-term perspective for the world. And then comes for them something which is extremely challenging, which is what they have as religious values, for the best people among them, connected to economics and concrete matters. And for people that have been based, of which wealth has been based on oil drilling, all of a sudden, they see a connection between moral values, religious values, and economic policy. And this for them is absolutely extraordinarily important.
That would be extremely important if some of these so-called religious leaders in the United States would make that connection. And Jacques, to move the venue a little bit, I know that a lot of people in the United States were wondering about what is the attitude now in France and Europe in general toward the war, especially since there's been such a very large buildup of American troops. in the Middle East. Do you find the same cynicism or pessimism in Europe?
No, no, no.
The war is inevitable?
Don't misunderstand me. They were not cynical or pessimistic. They were despaired and looking for something different. And they knew that around the LaRouche movement, there is something absolutely different, which represents for them power. So this is what interested them. And the best people there know that they have to escape from, on one side, the traditional conservative obscurantist proto-feudal mentality, and on the other side, they have to escape also from the consumerist westernization under Anglo-American rule. So the fear to be caught into a schizophrenic universe in this emirate with rigid habits and xenophobia on one side and mental and financial prostitution on the other. So what we have to say and the coherence of our approach is, for most of them, something totally new and absolutely unexpected coming from the West.
And the idea of the dialogue among civilizations, both functioning as a religious impetus, but also directly connected to what we might call the morality of LaRouche's economic policies.
Yeah, for example, some of these people understand Bernard Lewis' Arc of Crisis. They know about it. And they know that it is the evil British matrix of what is happening today and the inspiration for the crazy American utopians. They know about Wolfowitz, they know about Pearl, they know about Lewis Libby, they know about Douglas Fitz, they know about all these people. But they had no real in-depth knowledge of the policies of the Roosevelt or de Gaulle, except Roosevelt's discussion with the King of Saudi Arabia at the end of World War II. So they see LaRouche, or they have seen LaRouche until now, as a sort of unexpected planet. And for them, it's like an incredible eye-opener to see that LaRouche could be located, is located in a tradition, and to teach them the tradition from where it comes from. I had a class given to most of the deans of university in Qatar on LaRouche's economics, and there you had myself, in an improvised way, having on a piece of paper the LaRouche triple curve and the evolution of the world economy, and showing to them how there was deflation, now hyperinflation, the choice of Federal Reserve Governor Bernanke for hyperinflation, and so on and so forth. So this creates in them a tremendous interest. It's the first time that they hear something like that. An immense curiosity and hope is steered into people that tended to be a bit desperate about the future, desperate because they are in a closed universe. And all of a sudden, for them, the universe is open. And that's the important point, I think, of our presence there and the way they see us. For example, also, to locate the present debate in the Arab world in the tradition of Muslim thinkers of the 19th century, the anti-British, anti-colonial, jihad investigative tradition, has an immense impact from them coming from Westerners. They simply had never met before people who in a concrete way would tell them about that and know about that. So there we have us coming with Jamal al-Din al-Afghani, Muhammad Abdu, Ibn Badis, and saying, look at these people, look at the debate in the 19th century. Now it comes to a point where these people you should evoke in yourselves to be close to us and lead a fight together with us. So they see the dialogue of civilization becomes something extremely concrete with the strategy in economics, development of the Middle East, Eurasian land bridge, and New Bretton Woods. And then they understand, they see that also with the eyes of the Arab policy of de Gaulle. And they say, look, this is something new coming from France. At last, it's not only diplomatic maneuvers, but it's a real interest for a long-term perspective, both philosophical, religious, economic, and from the standpoint of physical economy, LaRouche's physical economy.
And, so and said, Jacques, what you're talking about is really is the way statesmanship should be conducted.
Sorry?
This is the way statesmanship should be conducted, the way
absolutely
nations do have dialogue on the philosophical, the scientific, the economic cooperation level, as opposed to the kind of insanity that's been injected, especially since the beginning of the 20th century, with British geopolitics dominating that region.
Well, and others too. The French were not much better, and the Americans, after some point, turned sour. So these people tend to see in their own desperate way, when they have nothing else coming to them, to see the West as bad, and it is very dangerous for them because they fall into traps. So all of a sudden they see something from the West inspiring. So this revives all the thinking of the 19th century and part of the 20th century in the Middle East, and not only in the Middle East, but in the Muslim world as a whole, of people saying, let's go back to the Quran and the Sunnah to find inspiration against traditionalism and conservatism, and against the degeneration also of the West. So, but we have to go back to these writings. We have to make the tajaddid, as they say. We have to, from a standpoint of an effort, a personal effort, we have not to be lazy. We have to go in depth into this issue. This is a jihad al-nafs, the war, the effort, inside effort to change. And then, usually, they won't socialize that, because they think that if they socialize that, they would be considered as weak and exploited. With us, they would socialize that, because they see somebody coming and trying to establish for them a way out of the inferno in which they have been dropped. They are victims of their own situation, because you see a society where the degree of freedom is extremely limited and at the same time exists. For example, in the university, 70% of the students are women and very advanced, but at the same time women are kept at home. So it creates a contradiction, and this contradiction would be extremely destructive except if it's connected to a positive development that we are bringing to them. So that's why they are so attracted.
This is a totally fascinating new look at the situation inside the Middle East, because, of course, in most of the Western press, especially in the United States, the Quran and Islam is presented as a religion of warfare. But I do want to move on to the question in Europe. Let me make a quick announcement for people who want to ask a question of Jacques. We have lines open. You can call us at 1-866-857-4327. International callers can reach us at 703-443-8419. And if you want to send an email, I'll give you this email address again. It's radio@larouchepub.com, LaroucheBub.com. Now, Jacques, I know we have some callers with some questions, but let me just ask you, coming back to Europe now, what is the mood, the sense you have in Europe over both the potential for war in the Middle East and also for possibility for changes in U.S. policy?
Everybody is against a war in the Middle East, almost everybody. The last polls in France show that between 70 and 80% of the people are against a war, so that's very clear. The thing is that you have this European disease, except to a certain extent in France and Germany and certain layers in Italy. When you come back from the Middle East, you have the impression that you come from countries where there is a freshness of mind, in a way, without deep knowledge. They need to be informed by knowledge. But in Europe, you have knowledge without this freshness of mind. So sometimes I happen to think that my job is to revive corpses. So that's a bit the impression I have, especially when I come back from such countries. But there are diplomatic maneuvers to avoid the war, to promote a war avoidance policy. But what I tell them, and I keep telling them in Europe, the people that I meet, and now I manage to meet some people, there is some openness as opposed to the past 10 years. People, I keep telling them, look, if you don't go for the Eurasian land bridge, for a new Bretton Woods, and if you don't look in depth, seriously, to what LaRouche is doing and saying in the United States, there is no way out. You will be trapped. Like I said at the end of my speech in the Middle East, what I said, I think it's the best way for the Middle East, but also for Europe to put it, is I said that challenge with a great evil, man has always the absolute possibility, capacity to respond with a greater good, but he should never compromise on the crucial issues. And there is no alternative in that sense to the new Bretton Woods that LaRouche has defined. And to try and to find out a second best choice would be to act like the man who cannot breathe because there is no air, and desperate tries to breathe something else. And there is not something else which could be a pathway for the future, a pathway for peace. In Europe, they have not yet decided to go courageously for this new Bretton Woods system and for his new, more just new world economic order.
But the new Bretton Woods system is being discussed. I know that the Italians have brought it up at the European Commission and also in the Italian Senate. And then you recently hosted a visit from Mr. LaRouche to Paris, which emphasized actually that maybe the one section of the population which doesn't act like corpses, namely the youth movement, which is now exploding in France. Can you say a couple words about that?
Two things. officially there is a lot of discussion, and except in Italy, the discussion is under the table, it's not over the table. So that's a problem. We have people that sign our new Bretton Woods Declaration, the last one from Helga Zeppelin-Larouche. We have people that sign deputies, parliamentarians in France, in Russia, in various countries of the world, in Italy, of course. We have that. But at the same time, there is a sort of last moment indecisiveness. They are indecisive, these Europeans, and you have to move them, to push them, hence the existence of our youth movement. And the youth movement is going to succeed, and I'm absolutely sure it's going to succeed and expand like a prairie fire, because precisely it steps on the grass where it's forbidden to step. And that's absolutely what we have to do in Europe to change the situation.
And it's also a way that you inject a certain sense of hope for the future, as opposed to a sense of impotent despair that there's no access to change.
It's just a paradox that enters into people's mind, and it's so powerful, is that you have there young people that think in terms of infrastructure for 10, 25, 50 years and represent the potential leadership for the world in a situation, as LaRouche defined it, where to be a leader would not be to be an eccentric, to be a unique person or a few persons, but to be a leader would be a matter of common discussion of social dynamics. And this, really, in a country like France, where you have people knowing a lot about many things, but blocked in social terms, and I think in a moment we should come to the issue of the French language, which is relevant to that, in that country, if we manage to open the cork of the bottle and let the genie out, it could not be never put back again in the bottle. And that's what we are doing, I hope.
Well, we have on the line a couple of young people from the LaRouche movement in the United States, and if they have some questions, they should let me know. And so if there are any people who have questions on the conference line, we can take them. Before they get on, Jacques, let me just ask you, what is the situation now with the economy in Europe? The euro has now been in business for a little over a year. There was resistance in France initially. How does that look at this point?
It looks, unfortunately, Mad Hatter's Tea Party. You have certain people, like Schroeder in Germany, who said we have to increase taxes. Other people that say we have to lower public expenses. Other people who say we have to subsidize consumption. And nobody tackles the real issue, a policy of productive investment and a policy of technological development. For example, in France, you have a big move to go back to nuclear energy. And the government said, we want to go back to nuclear energy and to promote the use of nuclear energy again. But at the same time, the EDF, the main French, the monopoly of electricity production in France, they try to privatize. And they try to create a situation where the pension funds would not be paid at the level which was pledged before. So you have this totally contradictory situation where on one side you say we are going to do something which is useful, which is good, like nuclear development, and on the other side you don't create the economic and social conditions to develop it. So that's what I call the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. And the French government, the German government, would only be able to move if they understand what's happening really in the United States with our movement, with the LaRouche movement, and if also they would connect with the markets of Asia in a much more forceful way. And this France and Germany and Italy have to do together and create this bridge between the Asian markets and Western Europe.
Was there a lot of excitement in Europe about in France in particular, about the stunning development of the maglev in China in a collaboration between Germany and China?
It's more in Germany. In France, people are provoked. Also, they are a bit angry because they say, what about our TGV, what about our trains? I say, look, the maglev is the most advanced technology. What we do have as advanced technology in France is a nuclear energy sector. So I see Germany contributing with the maglev, France probably a bit also in terms of transportation. It has to be coordinated with Germany, but also France contributing in terms of nuclear energy, peaceful use of nuclear energy for the development of China. And that combined probably with Russia, with France and Russia. And then you would create the conditions that in Germany they would go back into nuclear energy they have abandoned. So it's a very interesting distribution of cards, and it's a very interesting thing to look from above. If you look at it from above, you can create combinations that would change the situation in all the countries altogether with the dynamics of the whole. And this is what the youth movement is talking about in terms of the future. And what's very interesting is to, for these people in France, is to look about the future. There is also a turn, again, more favorable to space exploration also in that context. And remember, China has just announced that they would send a man in space that would be the third country in the world after the United States and Russia to send a man in space. So this also creates a big shock in France. So you have all these things that makes advance the conceptions that we defend, but there is a need, nonetheless, for a political decision, both in France and Germany, to confront the Anglo-American utopians forcefully, and at the same time, to understand and support our conceptions, the conception of LaRouche, in the present political situation internationally.
So it is a quite highly ironic situation where you see the best of so-called Western technology is now to be realized. It has to be realized in China, nuclear power plants being built in Iran. It's quite an irony, isn't it?
Or in South Africa also. It's quite an irony. Yes, the French have an operation in South Africa. So it's quite ironical. It's quite ironical that it's only in what is seen or is called the South, it's only there that things come up and are achieved. So I had a very interesting discussion with some youngsters, very young people of 10, 12, 15 years old, and one of them, who is an African, he asked a very good question. He said, but look, I look always at the world, and I always looked at these world globes. Why the South Pole is under and the North Pole is on top? Why is it like that? So that's a very good question.
So,
I said,
Jacques,
now, which what's happening, the South Pole
so
is coming up.
The message is out to people, and then we do have a question from Jason from San Leandro, one of the youth leaders from the LaRouche youth movement in California. So you're listening to the LaRouche Show, which is live every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the LaRouchePub.com website. If you would like to get on the show, you can call us at 1-866-857-4327. And also you can email us at radio@LaRouchePub.com. You can also get some articles that have been written by Jacques. Jacques is a prolific writer. I think you're still doing your articles almost every week in France for the newspaper there, and he's written quite a bit for the EIR. So if you'd like to get something that Jacques has written or transcripts of his speeches that have been covered in the EIR, you can call us at 1-888-EIR-3258. That's 1-888-EIR-3258. And you can tell them that you heard Jacques speak on the LaRouche Show and you'd like some copies of some of his writings that have been published in the Executive Intelligence Review, including the transcript of a speech you gave back in March of 2001 on Europe's task in creating the new Bretton Woods. So we're going to take a couple of calls. There are a couple of emails also. Let's start with Jason in San Leandro. Jason, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Harley.
Okay, go ahead. You're on with Jacques Cheminade.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, Jason.
What I was wondering about is that it's clear we need to have an international change in the world right now. And I know that from our discussions with state legislators and people in the United States, it's difficult to sometimes get them to even think of a nationwide problem, let alone an international one. So I was wanting to hear more about Lynn's role in the Middle East in getting these nations, because by bringing in LaRouche, they're clearly making an international intervention. And I also wanted to know a little bit more about the youth movement in France in terms of getting France to actually act to change the United States. Like, I wonder how people think about that in France, that you're out campaigning with LaRouche, you know, when you have book tables out.
Oh, yeah, all the time. There are two things. What you have to bring back in the mind of people is a Project America, both in the Middle East and in Europe, by the way. Project America is what the European countries wanted to build when it was impossible to build it in Europe. It was in the 17th century when, after some point, the social political conditions of Europe with the monarchies made it impossible to develop a form of society based on the nation state and based on the values of the Renaissance. This was destroyed by the wars of religion. So the chance was to establish it in the United States. And then the American Revolution, the American independence took place with support of people in particular from France, but from Germany also, and from Italy, and also from certain people from England, dissenters. So this created a situation where the United States, in a way, is the baby of Europe. So people have to see their responsibility today in fighting for their baby, for the United States, the true United States, which is LaRouche, and it's in that way that we present it, for LaRouche, which represent these values of the American tradition, of the American political system of economy, to defend that against utopians who are the Anglo-Dutch oligarchical Anglo-American perspective, the Wolfowitz, the Pearls, and the Douglas Fitz, the Libby's, etc. And these people are even crazier. They are lunatics. They are even crazier. And these Europeans understand. More lunatics than Kissinger, if you can imagine it. So people in Europe start to understand it. They start to see, for example, that presently there is in the Rumsfeld-controlled Defense Department an operation to slander France and Germany. There is an office for the strategic influence, which was closed, but then something else was established in the Pentagon with a deputy undersecretary for special plans, under William Lutty, who is a counselor of Dick Cheney. So these types have been launching operations against France and against Germany because of the attitude of the, for me, timid attitude, timid opposition to the war in Iraq. So, but from the standpoint of these crazy people, these utopians in the United States, they launched this big thing against France, Germany, and in particular against certain institutions like the aerospace institutions in Europe, and also the communications industry. There is a big attack. Also, people from Canada or the United States are believing that there is a tremendous anti-Semitism going on in France. So all these things, which are slanders, are promoted and tend to awaken people in France and Germany. But I said, you cannot say, oh, it's a bad American. This will be completely impotent. You have to say, we have to defend LaRouche because of that, because he represents the true America and not these other people. And this is what awakens people to the idea of what LaRouche is doing.
The second part of Jason's question, then, are you finding that there's openness in the French youth to see a different America, to look at LaRouche, to look at you, and see that there's something different than what they've been...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What they see different is first the enthusiasm. People are not enthusiastic in Europe, so they see the enthusiasm. That's the first impact. Second impact is that enthusiasm is based on ideas. It's based on discovery. It's based on principles, which is totally different of the other political parties. There are about nobody now in political parties in France. There are about 200,000 to 250,000 people who pay their dues to political parties in a population of 60 million. So it's about nothing. So we are recreating it for us an immense opportunity to recreate politics, to recreate a public debate with a meaning. And this can only be based on this notion of the Project America on one side, and on the other side, on the change in Europe in the context of this land bridge. So the two things have to go together, and the campaigns of Elga Zepp LaRouche, of Elga in Germany, and the campaigns we are leading in France should be a one from that double perspective, which is a one.
It's the old idea of the LaRouche movement, which was one fist across two continents. Now I think it's one fist across five continents, given that we have an international youth movement. Let me take another question from the conference line, and then
the world.
I think Jennifer from Baltimore is also on. But we have Doris. Are you there, Doris?
Yes. Hello?
Okay, go ahead, Doris.
In your travels there, are you running into any American soldiers? And if so, do you discuss any of these events with them?
No, I haven't seen any in the trip. I haven't seen any. There are many, but they are aside from the society, because if they are shown to the society, immediately there are riots. For example, there are a few things happening in Saudi Arabia that are not told by the press. They burnt a McDonald's recently. They attacked with stones American soldiers. They attacked with stones American people. They killed people in Yemen. As you have seen in the press, this was published. And these things are happening. And it's reactions of rage, impotent rage, but you can understand them from their standpoint. If we are not there, if we are not there to develop our conception, if they don't know about us, they would fall into states of impotent rage, and they would, their rage would be exploited and turned against themselves. So, by the utopians, young Americans today. So we have to change that. And that, the effort of that we are doing, and it would be very useful to meet some of these soldiers, some of these captains or some of these rank soldiers there, but you can see them. You go to the hotels, you go to the public places in Doha or in Abu Dhabi, there are no American soldiers. They are on their bases. They are isolated on their bases. And it's the same. If you look at what Grossman told about how you manipulate people and you transform them into killers, the same type of thing is occurring in the Middle East with isolation and putting people in a frenzy. And if people like us would be able to speak to them, I am sure the thing could be changed very fast, but they are in isolation.
There's an interesting development just from the last couple of days, Jacques, that you have a Congressman Charles Rangel from New York,
yes,
and then Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina, who have come out saying that in order to get away from this professional army, this idea of a Roman Empire or a Waffen-SS force in the United States, which is actually what it's modeled on. And in fact, it goes back to the utopian Samuel Huntington with his argument that you have to have a professional army. Rangel and Hollings have called for reinstating the draft. And Lyndon LaRouche has said that he would support this because of the idea of community service and also the idea of every citizen having to take responsibility for the nation's policy. Now, there's another caller online who has a question which I think you'll find quite interesting in terms of history of France. Marty, are you there? All right, well, he asked a question. He wanted to know, what about leftists in the United States who think the French Revolution was a positive
development? Marty's online.
Oh, Marty, you're on?
Yeah.
Okay, Harley, go ahead, Marty.
Harley, excellent show. I'm calling from New Orleans, former French colony. But I did want to, Harley started the question, but, typically the leftists in the U.S., look at the Jacobin terror of the French Revolution as a positive force in history and a model that perhaps are still relevant. I see this view being one of the biggest stumbling blocks for expanding the youth movement in the U.S. I was wondering if the same stumbling block exists in France.
It's a very good question. Yes, it does. Because if you want to steer a Jacobin movement, what you have to create is first hate, and hate without a perspective, a higher perspective. So you create a situation where through wars of religion, and this is what happened in France, and one of the problems of the French Revolution is that it was in the context of the wars of revolution of the 16th century and opposition to religion in the 18th century. So you lose a sense of the in-depth, long-term perspective, and you fall into the trap of a science or a conception of man based on immediate sense perception. And then you are lost, because the only way you can see the other tends to be an enemy, and the conception of the world becomes a conception of conflict and not a conception of common cooperation, of common development. And this was a Jacobin manipulation into the French Revolution. You can look at it from different angles into how it was promoted and how it was pushed by the British. The British pushed at the same time the Ancien Régime types, the feudalists of the land and the financiers, and at the same time the Jacobin insurrection, to create a fake debate into France and to destroy all the positive intentions that were into the French Revolution from the standpoint of people like Lafayette or people like Carnot. Lafayette and Carnot themselves had not a clear enough idea of this ideological question. And I think in history we are the only ones who had this clear ideological concept of what happened. And for us it's a very an enormous responsibility to be able to go back to the Renaissance spirit, to the spirit of Renaissance, through all the work we have done and all the developments that Lynn had made on this very precise issue. And the only way, I would say, if I want to make it in a bit provocative way, would be to learn the Gauss first theorem of algebra, but to go deeper into the history that led into this type of discovery. Because on one side you have a closed universe, universe of Lagrange, universe of Laplace, universe of a mechanistic universe, a mechanistic world, where everything is senses, and organization of deduction and induction, starting from what the senses had were perceived by the person. And on the other side, you had the conception of man as a person who creates hypotheses. So you have to create an environment, and that's a difficulty. You can't confront people simply with the failure, which was Jacobinism is. You have to, but it's not enough. You have to create an environment where they could discover it by looking at it from above. And you have to make all these efforts to have people looking at it from above, giving to them, like Socrates does, the capacity to come out into themselves with somebody that was potential in them and that become actualized through the organizing of these people. This is what Lynn answered in a very, very beautiful way to Cody once in California. I read that in the briefing and we published it in the French paper. I think it was a marvelous answer from Lynn to Cody. So that's the answer against this Jacobinism. And it's a real problem because
the Bastille Day is still one of the big holidays, isn't it?
It is a big holiday. It's confused because certain people say that the 14th of July is not only the Bastille, 1790, which was the last opportunity where there was this Feast of the Federation, where all the nation was bounded together by Lafayette and so on and so forth. But it's very confused in the mind of French people, and they have not put thinking behind it. Because if they put thinking behind it, they know that they have to change their behavior today, and they know that they have to go into the history of France. I discussed it with Lynn, this issue, and what he said is that you have to write a paper that I started to give presentations on this paper, but now I have to write it, on the mission of France. And he said if you don't describe a mission of France throughout history, and if you don't put it forcefully forward, then you would have outside of your organization, but also inside, probably, a set of Jacobite insurrections, because people would tend to react in a given environment with a Jacobine impulse instead of seeing it from a higher way, from the way of hypotheticizing, seeing it from a broader perspective. They would have no air, and they would not be able to breathe. So with this Mission of France paper that I have to write, and they would write in the next weeks, this is like giving air to the youth movement and giving perspective into the Project America of France.
Well, it's good to see Lynn is keeping you busy there, Jacques.
Yeah, always.
In the United States, we have a similar problem where you have fools like former Senator Phil Gramm who insist that Adam Smith was the founder of the American economic system. So this is a common problem. We really have to win back people to understand what is the real history of the world based on understanding what is the nature of man.
But if you put people in such a situation that they have to look into their contradictions, they are very angry at the beginning, and then they like to look at it. The best people like to look at it and see, oh, I have changed. I did not notice it, but I have changed. That's interesting, and this makes life more interesting. So I would go back to the source and try again to drink at it again and again, and then people start to be organized.
Absolutely. So you're listening to the LaRouche Show with our special guest today, Jacques Cheminade. And I'm really happy, Jacques, you could join us today because you are giving people a different perspective than they ordinarily would get. Now, if Jason is still on, in keeping with what you've just been discussing, Jason did have a question on language that he wanted to ask you. Jason, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, why don't you go ahead with your question?
I didn't have a particular one about the language since I don't know that much about the history, but I had read the report from the Solidarity and Progress meeting that was in the briefing, and there was a discussion about the French language. I wanted to hear more about it, about more some of the changes that were made, or about how when the pronunciation was changed, and you know why all these letters are no longer said. Whatever you'd want to say on that subject, and also about you know how it prevents people from thinking in France today.
I think you should do one thing first, is to win an invitation to come to France. With that question, you have won it. And you should bring two or three people with you, and that will be very good. So this is a challenge. Then for the language, French was in the 15th, 16th century, the language spoken in all Europe from Russia to Spain as a common language. So, and it was on the basis of a nation-state concept that Joan of Arc fight and then Louis XI's nation-state building had forcefully put together. So then you had this nation-state with this language around Europe. This, from the standpoint of the Venetians, from the standpoint of the Dutch, which were starting their operations, this thing had to be destroyed. So they used against it first the wars of religion. And the wars of religion were seen as a trouble that only a centralized monarch could master and prevent. So they promoted the centralized monarch with the Council of Trento ideology, the ideology of a what they would call a Roman Catholic imperial standpoint, which had nothing to do with Christianity or with Catholicism, but it was a Roman Catholic imperial standpoint that you could see in Spain with first Charles V and then Philip II, and in France with Henry II. And Henry II, when he entered into Paris, when Francis I died, he entered into Paris like a Roman emperor, practically, on a carriage with Catherine de' Medici, who had introduced the wars from Italy. So Henry II and Catherine de' Medici were there, and behind the carriage were two giants sculpted, carved in wood. And one was held with a chain by the tongue and the other by the ear, which meant that the king had to control the tongue and the ear of everybody. So that tells you what was done with the language. And then the language was progressively through the 16th century, as the wars of religion went on, there was a escapist pornographic use of language by a fake conception of poetry. So what Rabelais before had tried to do, which is to establish a lively language, to follow the inspiration of Dante, to make of French a language capable to convey the highest conceptions and the highest ideas and the highest forms of human emotions. This was destroyed by this banal court language, which at the same time that it was developed, were developing the furious, horrible religious massacres between Protestants and Catholics. So in this disaster, it led until 1594, where there was the Edit de Nantes. The Edit de Nantes was a matrix of the Peace of Westphalia. In 1594, Henry IV had this Peace of the Edit de Nantes, and he tried to stabilize things with a policy of common development, that both Catholics and Protestants could be integrated in one state with a common economic project of development. It worked, but at the same time, in terms of culture, the operation continued, the destructive operation continued, and it went against language. So there was a poet called Malherbe who reduced language to something in two-dimensional, with two dimensions.
Almost like a computer code, huh?
Yes, like a computer code. And they first destroyed the relation of language with the human voice, with music. That's the first thing they did. They said, everything that you conceive well, you can express clearly, and there are always words to express it. So, like a computer code. Then they said they destroyed the tonality in the language. They put it like one thing that there was no diphthongs, no triphthongs, and they destroyed the active verbal forms. And instead, they put the emphasis on nouns. So they create something like, as you said, a computer language, but a very distinguished, very British-like form in a French way. So this thing today has decayed to such a point that it has been adopted by the bureaucracy. First it was adopted by the bourgeoisie. It came from the oligarchs, it was adopted by the bourgeoisie, and then by the teachers and the bureaucrats. And you see, when I was years and years ago in the French administration, I was mad at certain meetings, because you see trade unionists or farmers going to these meetings with their own language, which was not a perfect language. It was heavily impaired by this Frenchness, historical Frenchness in the language, but they tried to express true things. And on the other side, there was these people, the bureaucrats from the administration, who had all the words, all the right way to say things, like a perfect computer, and they would completely intimidate the people that were saying the truth, and they were winning over them through this manipulation of language. This, for me, was striking. And then Lynn, we had the first discussion with Lynn on Rabelais, and I said, look, that's it. That's what I have seen with my own eyes. LaRouche is putting the finger on it. And Rabelais is absolutely what we have to promote and what we have to develop. So Rabelais is one thing we have to read to go back to this French of the 16th century.
And we do have, from the Fidelio magazine, we have a couple of articles recently on the importance of Rabelais and the importance of Rabelais from the standpoint that Lynn always discusses of the develop the power to communicate great ideas. We're down to about 7 minutes, Jacques, and I want to see if Jenny from... Baltimore has a question on the conference line. Jenny, are you there?
Yeah, I have a question.
Hi.
Hi. I'm in Baltimore. I had a question about sort of a Joan of Arc question. Here in Baltimore, we've been discussing a lot this idea that Lynn has been putting out about sublime leadership. And the interesting thing is that in order to communicate it to young people here, you have to use a frame of reference, and they don't have much of a historical reference at all. So we usually use, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King and Lynn as communicating sublime leadership, because that's about as far back as American young people can go. So my question is, do the French youth at all identify with Joan of Arc as a sublime leader? Do they have historical reference at all of Joan of Arc?
I would say something more on the preceding question and then go into your question, because it's related.
Okay.
If you see, you can't go into the French language question, into Rabelais in itself. Mm-hmm. It has to be linked to some to political action and being based on a change in the political framework of the whole country and the whole world. So language has not to be seen as something in itself. But it has to be developed in the sense of a political advancement of ideas and a political fight, and we tend too often to separate the two. What I did in this language discussion is I put two the Gaulle speeches. The first one, one of the first, when he was in 1940 in London, and he said I had to pick up the broken torchlight of France. And then at the liberation of Paris, where he gave a speech on the liberation of Paris, totally improvised. So in the two cases, you could see that when deep emotions come to people, like de Gaulle in such cases, the language changed, and you see a shift in the language. And this is a way to push. Well, de Gaulle himself was unable to push on this issue. He could express it at a certain point, but it was not organized as a movement pushing for this issue. LaRouche has helped us to do precisely that. To do that, a subject matter of the connection between the emotions and the emotions appropriate to fight, to lead a political fight. I think that's fundamental. So back to Joan of Arc. We have the same problem in France. Don't believe that Joan of Arc is seen as something understood by the French population. It has been kidnapped. Joan of Arc has been kidnapped at the end of the 19th century by the anti-German faction. And they said Joan of Arc for the British in the... In the 15th century, now Joan of Arc is a symbol of a fight against Germany, because Germany is occupying the Lorraine and the Alsace departments of France, so Joan of Arc became the symbol of the anti-German. Then she became the symbol of the conservatives and the right-wingers. So we have to recapture Joan of Arc out of the hands and go back to what she really was. And the Schiller play is for that fundamental, because what you see in the Schiller play is the first moment of Joan of Arc when she had a commitment, she had a task, and she fights for it. And then that's not enough. It has to be inside herself as an inner god, and she develops that after she overcome the question of the earthly attachment with Lionel, and she goes to a higher standpoint where she's totally committed to change, for the improvement of the nation, and to contrary to Hamlet, not to be afraid of immortality, but living in immortality. And this is a key question. And if you look at the culture, from the American culture, also what's happening in France today, what they make you live in is the present, the immediate, the instant. So you have, by all means, to get people out of the instant, out of the present, to give them a span of time that would be broadened and broadened and broadened. And all of a sudden, through this span of time, they have the sense, they begin to have a sense of immortality and of the present, past, and future. And then, with that sense, they can understand the Joan of Arc, and then of a sudden, it's for them an opening, a tremendous opening, because they do understand it. Elodie, in a class in Brittany, I was not there, but I heard about it, did it in a quite powerful way, because she created a discussion precisely around that. And then you could see Joan of Arc not as something separate or as something which tends to be seen as a given something, but Joan of Arc as really the embodiment of the sublime, and something that she's telling us to embody today in the same way. Not something like most Frenchmen do, that they think it's history books, it's captured, there are images of her. All the sculptures, by the way, of her are generally bad. There are very few that are good, that capture this sublime, the character of the sublime. So you have to create for people this sense of a higher form of temporality, that time is not an absolute, but is subjected also to change, and is subjected to change from the standpoint of your fight for a better future, looking into the past and changing also the past from the standpoint that you accomplish something that the past persons wanted you to accomplish. What Joan of Arc wanted to be accomplished, you are accomplishing it.
Jacques, we're down to just a little bit more than a minute, and speaking of the future, I'd just like to know if you are planning another campaign for President of France.
Well, now all our campaigns are to support LaRouche for 2004. That's fully. You're fully in that. But yes, we are planning for 2007. Let's see what happens in this period. It will be absolutely necessary given what's happening now in France, or what's not happening yet in France.
Well, I think
so. With Elga, we are trying to combine something for the Franco-German Treaty, for the celebration of the Franco-German Treaty of January 22. It was in 63. We are in 2003. It's 40 years after, and it's about time that we do something better.
Well, Jacques, I think, speaking on behalf of people in the youth movement, we'd be more than happy to welcome French members of the LaRouche youth movement to come to the campaign, and I think we could make you an honorary youth and invite you over to come and campaign for Lynn.
Oh, I would like it. I would be delighted.
Well, Jacques, thank you very much. This has been the LaRouche Show with Jacques Cheminade from France. I'm Harley Schlanger, and until next week, next Saturday at 3 p.m., this has been the LaRouche Show.